Hello, everyone, and thanks for coming to our talk. We're here, as you heard, to talk about local journalism, why it matters, and especially why we as anti-fascists should care about it. And to talk about that, I invited Priyanka from Bristol. She's the editor of the Bristol Cable, and as you heard, it's a very special local newspaper that is not owned by a commercial private company, but by several thousand people in the city of Bristol, city in the southwest of England. Yeah, and Priyanka is also the host of a great podcast. I recommend you all to listen to it. People Just Do Something, talking to people doing some kind of activism. And yeah, we're here to talk about the Bristol Cable, about some reporting the Cable does, and about one badass anti-fascist investigation they just did, or their last big investigation that basically smashed a far-right group in Bristol, but we're going to hear more about that later. First, welcome and thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah, as you can tell, we are both wearing Bristol Cable shirts. I got it as a present because this is how we know each other, and how this idea to have a panel on it came together is because I've been visiting you, the Bristol Cable, in the beginning of the year for 2 months. And now you heard it already, I work at the local desk of TUTS, and I'm just interested in local journalism. And one of the questions why I was visiting the Cable that we're also going to talk about today is that I used to be part of Radio Korax. You've heard about it, community radio in Halle in the state of Sachsen-Anhalt that is right now very much under threat by the far-right AfD, who wants to cut all their funding. And this question, because Radio Korax, it's the only left media in Sachsen-Anhalt, it's a very important political place, not only media, but also like a physical space for people to meet in Halle. And I think it's kind of a contradiction for an anti-fascist radio to rely so much on state funding, because of course it can be taken away. Still, money has to come from somewhere. This is one of the things we want to talk about. But maybe to start with, and before we explain more what the Bristol Cable is about, because I think we can learn a lot from you, I would like to ask you, Pri, why should we care about owning our own media?
Yes. I think to understand why, I will talk a little bit about the UK context. Maybe people know about it. When the Cable was founded in 2014, it was really a time when Rupert Murdoch had come to the UK and bought up increasingly more and more newspapers. He really, I think it's a bit brazen how corrupt it is, of like he would literally trade favorable coverage of politicians so that they would change the regulations so he could own more and more of a media monopoly. And, you know, it's really stark, like with, and the papers that they run under News of the World was like The Sun, Daily Mail, these are real like gutter journalism papers who mainly do like gossip. I mean, when Rupert Murdoch took it over, he literally said, I want tits and gossip in it, you know? He didn't hide the fact that he wanted to take out the public interest journalism out of the papers. So I think what came in the rise of this, of him owning so much of the media, is the rise of these really terrible practices. We had a huge scandal in the UK about phone hacking. A lot of these journalists were hacking into people's phones in order to get stories on them, or at worst, like entrapments, like people who would pretend to be someone they're not, catch a celebrity in a compromising situation and then post it. And it led to a huge inquiry and a real moment of like, wow, it's media has got really bad. Like in the UK, I don't know how it is here, but if at that time, if you ask people what is the least trusted profession in this official polling that happened, like it was estate agents, lawyers, journalists, which is a terrible state of affairs. So I think, and then simultaneously what had happened is the big corporations had bought out a lot of local media titles as well. They were going to these organizations like Reach and NewsQuest, and in buying up all of these papers, it meant that hundreds of local newspapers have shut down across the UK, have been swallowed up in these, you know, big titles. And obviously when you run a newspaper on a market logic, you lose the incentive to do proper investigative journalism that holds power to account, that upholds a democratic purpose, because you want to make profit, basically. And the way, if you look at the shady structures behind a lot of these local news outlets who own all these local titles, they're often controlled by, you know, BlackRock, other companies who are involved in all kind of tax dodging company, you know. And what has been really terrible to see is that because of the drive to make sure that there is always enough to pay shareholders dividends, where do they take the money from? It's the newsroom. And how do they make money? Is advertising on the website, which means that you get the rise of clickbait journalism, so people just click on it. Some of this is same in Germany?
Definitely. Similar? Like, I mean, what you're describing is the private commercial sector of local media, which exactly. is very different, very similar, I would say. Maybe, I mean, in Germany, there are also regions with very few local media. Mm. I think, I'm not sure, but I think the situation might be a bit better, especially about the trust in journalists, but it's the same problem. It's like if profit or like a commercial interest stands behind the local media, right?
Exactly. And you know, like, so to answer your original question of why it's important to own your own media, it's so that you don't have to run it on a business logic, which is counter to the very fundamentals of journalism, is it in a nutshell. And that's why when the cable came about, the whole idea was that it would be owned 100% by its members. So we run as a cooperative, and it's a very successful model. We kind of shouldn't have worked, because everything that other sectors of journalism will tell you, we don't do. So nothing is behind a paywall. All our journalism is free to access. We print a paper 4 times a year, and online, you know, we publish maybe once a week, a bit less. Started doing podcasts, but nothing is behind a paywall. Everything is free to access. We don't take any advertising on our website, and we have a very strict ethical advertising charter about who we are allowed to take ad money from, and that is only goes in the paper, and it's a tiny percent of our model. The only thing is, we are a little bit reliant on grant funding, and we have managed to increase our membership to a point where actually just membership alone, which by the way is only £1 a month to be a member, because again we really believe in this commitment of journalism not being like a privilege or inaccessible, you know, so we try and keep it as low as possible. So the minimum is £1 a month.
But you still need more money, like from grants.
Exactly. So now our membership accounts for 60% of our running, and we get paid fairly ish, you know, not great, but we get paid. We all we have a flat structure internally. We try and keep our internal processes a bit, would do things differently as well. We like organize in a kind of consensus-based way. But the really important thing for us is we would like to be 100% funded by our members. It's not a reality yet, and I think we struggle with this problem of being a bit understaffed or trying to do things on a very shoestring budget with not a lot of time. But just when we tell, like, the cable is by far, I think, the most successful example of independent newsroom, a local independent newsroom. We're part of the networks of independent local papers in the UK. We've helped other people to start up as cooperatives. We've helped people like, you know, Fumasa in Lisbon, for example, to set up as a cooperative. Like, I very strongly believe that owning your own media is the best way to make sure that you stick true to the principles of journalism.
And now, you already said, like, the idea is to be 100% member funded. It's not a reality yet, but I mean, this is what I found interesting somehow, like, how can we sustainably finance local media that is independent and somehow really serve the public interest in a way.
Yeah.
And yeah, you said like the opposite, or we were talking about the opposite, the commercial private local media and how maybe like the content that they publish may be influenced by who are the shareholders, that they have to make profit, that they do take adverts and so on. Still, I want to say there's a lot of great local media newspapers or outlets in Germany. I think there are one, some in the UK as well, who just like, for example, speak about report on schools that close or a restaurant that has opened or something like that. And I think just the like the basic idea of local journalism is that people feel like their reality are somehow important, that what they experience in their life is important and it takes place somewhere in the public space. There's someone who might like critically look or ask the local council or something like that. I mean, often it doesn't work like this, or a lot of local news outlets are shut down, but still there are local journalists also for private commercial media working like this. And the cable does this as well, but what is it like that you would say is different about how you work and how you work as journalists?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the thing that makes us really unique is our cooperative model, because I think exactly what you're saying about how one of the reasons why local journalism is so important is that it makes you feel more integral to the city, makes you feel heard. You know, there are countless studies about how in areas with a good local journalism there is a higher level of like civic democratic engagement, people will vote more and things like this. So for us, we say that we have an engagement driven model, and what we mean by that is with our cooperative, and it's a community benefit society is the legal structure. Our members we legally need to run our finances by them. So we will do an annual general meeting every year where we talk about our finances, and it has to be very transparent. Our members stand to be our directors. And that's the board that we report to, is of members who are then voted on at this AGM as well. And if we were to ever do something that would significantly change what our core work was, we have to run it past our members, which is why we've had slogans, you know, like an old membership slogan was, you buy in so we can't sell out. Like, we literally cannot say tomorrow, I think we're going to be bought out by Google, because we would have to ask our members and our members would say no, you know. So I think it's a way of also making people feel like part of a cooperative, part of building something, involved somehow. You get a newsletter, you get to talk to the journalists more, you have more of an access. So I think that this building engagement is really important, is one thing. I think another thing is that the cable was founded by community organizers and activists and not journalists. They taught themselves the journalist and they did it very well, but I think that is something which is a different positioning of the role of local media. You see yourself more as a kind of a community actor rather than just this high up commentator a bit, and our events and community organizing is really key for this. We have a role of community organizer. One of the things he's running at the moment is like a school of activism. Actually, that's free and online, so anyone can come. But yeah, so he does the basics of community organizing training. So that's the other part of it. And then I think we, as a newspaper, are not at all tied to the news cycle. We publish more in-depth investigations or detailed features, and what we are guided by in as editorial values is what is in the public interest, what do people need to know, how can we hold power to account, whose voices are being marginalized. And we think a lot about how we frame things, a very significant part of the editorial process. For example, recently when we did a whole print edition about migration in Bristol, we talked to a lot of like migrants' rights networks and charities to understand like what's the correct language to use, or what is good framing, not to play into some of the tropes or stereotypes that I think are often peddled by a lot of mainstream media a bit without question. So I think that's a really important thing that we do, is challenge received narratives of, you know, the manufactured consents that the mainstream papers are doing.
I mean, we've been talking, or like circling this question now, about the anti-fascist aspect of local media already, because I feel like when we think about how to fight the far right, we often like think of demonstrations, or maybe people will post on Instagram, attend this or that demonstration or so. And I feel like people do not talk a lot about local media and owning their own media. And I mean, you said something about it, but what would you say in Bristol that made you feel like, okay, local media is something that we should care about as anti-fascists? Or where does it, can it help like fighting the far right or the rise of the far right?
I mean, I believe so passionately in the role of independent media. It's like, this is the conversation that I will often have like drunk at parties, you know, I'm like that person. And it's not particularly sexy to be like, the revolution is local media co-ops, but I feel like they have a very strong role in it. I think for one thing, so much of what right-wing media in the UK, maybe everywhere, plays on is a sense of like disenfranchisement. Like, I think a lot of anger in working classes or people who feel very like left behind by society, not listened to, not heard, not represented, not reflected, that is perfect ground for the far right to capitalize on and give to those people a scapegoat or an outlet, or it's this person's fault or that thing. And so I think that is a really key thing to fight in the first instance, of you just need to make people, local people, feel a part of something and seen. But I also think I don't think the cable officially goes around saying that we are anti-fascist, or, you know, we would say we're like independent and like it's very obvious that we're left wing, but again, it's not officially in our messaging for various reasons.
Makes sense as an independent outlet.
Yeah, but I think we are running a membership campaign at the moment, a very dedicated membership campaign, so we can reach this target we have of doubling our membership in the next 5 years. And one of our slogans is no good politics without good media. And I think it's true, because there is such a complicity between the state and the right-wing media. For example, when it comes to things like, of course immigration is too high. It's just like, it's just peddled as a truth. Of course it is. You know, recently, whenever riots happen, for example, at the moment, this bizarre thing which is happening at the moment, because we've seen an uptake in far-right violence protests since 2024. Those people are now claiming that white people are severely discriminated against by the police, and they are using a lot of the slogans and language of Black Lives Matter movements to say, like, there was a big demonstration recently being like, I can't breathe was a slogan, like, no justice, no peace, and it was very, like, bizarre. And then the mainstream media, even the center, which is particularly annoying, will say, some will say that there is a two-tier policing, and actually there is such a culture of political correctness in the police that white people are now being discriminated against. And you're like, do you want to give that a bit of perspective? Like, here's this mountain of evidence against like racism in the police and discrimination and years of history, disproportionate imprisonment of Black and brown communities. You know, and so I think that there's things like that which feels like, oh, if we just need a different narrative. And then I think probably our most explicit anti-fascist work was when we have done investigative journalism into the far right, and our latest investigation, well, our last investigation was part of that.
Yeah, it was like already ongoing when I was visiting your newsroom, and I we've talked about this before, but it was like one of my third or fourth day when I was running from the police with one of your colleagues, Adam Kwashi, because we were watching a demonstration by a local far-right group, the Bristol Patriots, which is a very like new phenomenon, as far as I understood, in Bristol. And yeah, you did this investigation that was ongoing after and published it some months later, and it had quite an impact. Like, the group doesn't really exist anymore. Maybe can you take us to the beginning and explain what you did?
Yeah, absolutely. Also, what a welcome to Bristol. This is also why we were like, she's gonna do fine here, like day three running from the police at the demo. So in 2024, again, I don't know how much of this news has come across to here, but in 2024, there was a really horrible case in Southport of some young girls being stabbed to death at a dance class. A rumor went round that it was a Muslim immigrant who had done this. That's a lie, actually. But the rumor went round very quickly, and it saw a huge wave of far-right violence, and it was completely capitalized on by all the bad actors in the UK to say, you know, this is what immigration does. You know, this is the worst aspect of it. And it was a really disgusting time to exploit tragedies like this. It's happening again now. So yes, all these riots started happening. What they used to do is, what they would often do is go and protest outside hotels known to be housing migrants. One was even set on fire, like a huge spike in racism across the board during these times. And so that summer, I think it came to Bristol. And I have to say, I don't know if you know Bristol, but it's a pretty lefty city, and we're a bit complacent about that sometimes. Like, but I know, having grown up in Bristol, that I know that I know that we're not all this like lefty liberal utopia. Like, I know that especially in the outskirts where poverty is higher, we're still there's a huge wealth discrepancy, a big divide. I know in those areas there are more right-wing views, so I wasn't totally surprised to see it. But still, I think it did take us a little bit by surprise that there was anyone at all. And there was a summer of protest then. Some would happen outside migrant hotels. I have to say, they were completely outnumbered by the anti-fascists in Bristol. Anti-fascists came out in hundreds and hundreds, you know, more or less outnumbering them like 1 to 10 or 1 to 4 at least, which is always very good to see. But yeah, so we have been building the investigation until then. And then we're waiting for the right moment, and the right moment came in March.
What happened?
So the face of the far right in the UK is a bit complicated. The Tory party, the Conservatives, now not in power, have become a bit redundant. Nigel Farage's party, UKIP, has been kind of rebranded and taken over by a guy called Nick Tenconi, and is restyling itself as more of like a street mob party, not necessarily running candidates, but they do a lot of like in the streets demonstrations. And they've also completely rebranded to be a Christian nationalist party. So now their marches, they are walking down London with common prayer books in their hand and crucifixes and saying Jesus is king and this is a white Christian country and the re-migration narrative. And then there is Reform Now, which is Nigel Farage's party. And then worse still is Restore, who are even to the right of Reform, if you can imagine. And Tommy Robinson is this big cult figure, obviously, in the UK, who gets a lot of people to come out and does manage to mobilize a lot of people.
Far-right activist, neo-Nazi kind of guy, is the one who like organized this very huge far-right protests in London,
In London, exactly. And I think another group that's come out of all this is called Patriotic Alternative, and the local chapters of this in Bristol, you know, they're the Patriots. So the Bristol Patriots were the group that we were seeing in Bristol. And at first it was just a kind of, you know, in early 2024, 2025, it was just like, I don't think they were particularly organized. And then as time went on, you started seeing, okay, they've got a slogan now, they've got a banner now, they've got T-shirts now, you know, they're branding, trying to pull people in from neighboring cities in the Southwest because they don't have the numbers in Bristol. So yes, we've been reporting on this for a while. And then I think there was another protest planned in March. In fact, it was on March. It was on the 8th of March. And what was particularly unnerving to me about this one is they called it, what did they call it? It was like a Together for All March.
Unity March.
March for Unity. And they put every religious symbol on the leaflet except for the one of Islam. And I think I was like, wow, what an insidious tactic that they're going for the party. You know, they're branding themselves what now is the party of inclusion and religious tolerance, like the irony. And we went, and there was a very small number of people, but we've now had sort of been working with our anti-fascist group in Bristol, does incredible work, and we've worked very closely with them on this one. They've been like developing intel on this for years. Worked with us to identify them. There was that great talk earlier about investigative tools. We used a lot of those to identify who the main culprits were, who are the people who are coming again and again. I was at this protest with someone who worked at the Bristol Cable who is Jewish, and there is a guy in the far in part of the far right called Ryan Ferguson. And he's not from Bristol. He's just a guy that people kind of, he's like a renter racist. He'll just turn up to your marches and say unspeakable things and get a lot of rage bait clicks online. He was there and he started saying some really awful anti-Semitic stuff to my colleague. And it was outrageous and the police didn't do anything. And we filmed it and we posted it. And I think because we were the ones who got that footage and I confronted him about it afterwards, I think it alerted a lot of people to the hypocrisy, which is very important, I think, to show in local journalism of like, this is the March for Unity, where they have the Star of David on their leaflet, and this is what they're saying. And all the other people who I would talk to as well, because I always talk to the fash, I think it's important, and I would say, well, what do you think about this guy? And they're like, oh yeah, he's a bit extreme, but... you know, it doesn't reflect all of us, but they're not asking him to leave either, you know? So I think it was very important to show... I think it embarrassed them, because it embarrassed them the hypocrisy of what they were doing, you know? And the kind of softer fash who will just say, oh, it's just about immigration, and no, it's just extremism, it's just Muslim extremism that we don't like. I think it just... There were enough of them who were saying awful things, acting terribly, that it embarrassed the organization. So we very quickly pulled all of the years of research together and outed them as well. We identified all the key culprits and what they'd done and other protests they were at and other kind of... We worked with a great organization in the UK called Hope Not Hate as well, also Open Democracy, and exposed the people for who they really were. And another huge contradiction that's happening, another thing, hypocrisy, which I think is great to point out as well, is a lot of these people are saying that they're marching on behalf of women and girls, because they say that asylum seekers are, raping English girls or something. And the amount of people who have domestic abuse priors, convictions, these things, you know, that's another thing that we managed to expose. And I think pointing holes in their logic and the hypocrisy of it really does a lot to undermine people's faith in them. And the fact that we had this hate crime recorded that we could send to the police, I think a combination of these things meant that when the investigation did come out, it hit really hard. And some days later, I don't want to claim total credit for this, but some days later, the Bristol Patriots posted something like, we have decided to shut down for a period of reflection.
It's a good story. I think it's interesting that you say it's important to point out the hypocrisy, because just to throw something into the conversation from Germany, there has been like a scandal and also started in Sachsen-Anhalt, in the state of Sachsen-Anhalt, within the AfD about like corruption, and people like employing their family members within party structures, and one of them made it all public, and then, yeah, it was a huge scandal. It came out that a lot of them do pay family members, and still, it didn't really hurt them yet. But I think you're right, and I think this, like, people who think about voting the AfD are maybe not totally convinced and have this feeling like the politicians somehow only take the money and put it into their own pockets or so. They might think about it another time now, as they know about that.
I mean, it's the same with Nigel Farage. The only thing that I've seen actually dent his popularity, I mean, maybe there have been a few things, but the one thing that really seems to have unnerved a lot of people is this £5 million donation he got from a crypto billionaire. That, you know, and he always says, oh, I'm a man of the people, you know, despite the fact that he's a well-known investment banker and not at all like an everyman. But, you know, his thing is to be with a beer in a pub, and he's like the everyman. And I think when this came out, it definitely, yeah, I mean, it's good to expose them for the hypocrites they are.
Yeah. Back to the Bristol Patriots, who started as somehow like kind of a small, maybe sad group. We can also talk about, I would like to talk about you later, maybe a little bit about what you said, that you think it's important to talk to the FESH. But before that, you mean, it sounds like a success story, but it also, something happened after you published, that someone probably connected to them came to your office. And I think this is something that a lot of, especially local journalists, experience. To get threatened by the far right, or can you tell us what happened there?
Yeah, we had had a lot of discussions about the security risks that come with covering the far right, being doxxed. We did a bit of a like digital hygiene, I think we called it, of like how to, which I would recommend to everyone, of like, yeah, just trying to make sure that there is as little as possible about you online. And we had tips like, not that any of us in the newsroom use local social media very much, but like, don't post where you are live, take a different route to work every day. And it was very difficult to think, like, you know, is this a bit
over the
dramatic,
top.
Over the top? Exactly, I thought that. One day I wasn't actually in the office, but I got a very distressed call from the reception in our building saying that a man had come in, very angry, very threatening. He was saying, like, do you know the vile propaganda that the cable is spreading? And then he took a picture of what floor the cable was on. He abused the woman at reception, who was a black woman, and felt very harassed and intimidated. He then went outside and took pictures of all the security cameras. He was trying to get upstairs. And, I mean, we're not going to let it stop us, but it was not nice to have our people in the building have to take that hit. I think as journalists, maybe you're a bit prepared for it. But yeah, our board of directors got involved. They said maybe don't go to the office for a bit. We even discussed about leaving the office and maybe being a bit more low profile. But luckily, that's been the only incident. And I mean, it's not gonna stop us. Clearly, it's meant to harass us, and we don't want to let them win.
Do you have any plans? I understood, like, you think about looking at them again, like, at the organization. And, I mean, they're basically, like, somehow based in Bristol, but part of something that happens all over UK. Mm-hmm. So what's next? What are you planning? What are you working on?
The next stage is this extremely small group who are now Bristol Rises, which is the rebrand of Bristol Patriots. But there have been a few times where they've said that they were going to do demonstrations, and it's just a party of anti-fascists. Like, they don't really turn up, or maybe one guy turns up and then sees that none of his friends are here and hides the flag and goes home. So it's a bit pathetic, but obviously it's something that we're keeping an eye on it. And now, in the slight lull, but we're always ready, because it only takes one mainstream news incident. Like, recently it happened that a boy was stabbed to death in the UK, and the man who did it happened to be a Sikh man, again, British national, he was born here. But this has now led to more far-right riots. Because of the way it's immediately capitalized on and spun, whenever anyone black or brown does anything, then it is a referendum on immigration. Everybody has to go, you know, or the far-right go to the streets and use this opportunity. So we're ready for that. But I think now what we want to look at is the policing involved, again, to counter this mainstream narrative of this two-tier policing that affects...
It was the case like where people said the police did something wrong, or...
You mean this stabbing case?
Yeah,
well, the police was an idiot. The man said, "I've been stabbed," and the police arrested him and said, "I don't think you have, mate," handcuffed him, and he bled to death. But instead of saying, what an incompetent fucking moron of a police officer, they're saying that the culture of the police is such that everyone is so afraid to be racist that he let this happen, which is like an amazing perversion of all common sense and logic. But in Bristol, what we're looking at now is how the anti-fascists have been policed, because it is disproportionate. Like, we know people who have been followed, or on the days of protests like this, the police will turn up to their houses sometimes. There is an anarchist social centre in Bristol, which is often, we get reports that it's maybe being surveilled or something like this. And also the use of force in these protests. I mean, I get real battered around in these last couple of ones. There's like riot police, horses, batons, pepper spray for the anti-fascists. It just... I think we want to catalogue a bit the policing of the anti-fascists, because it's been disproportionate, a disproportionate excessive use of force. So that's what we're going to look at next, as well as keeping tabs on this Bristol Rises.
All right, a lot to look forward to. We will keep an eye on the Bristol cable. I promised to ask you about talking to the... like people who attend the far-right protests, and I don't want to lose my promise, so I will ask you. I mean, this one time I was talking about, and after that you will all have the opportunity to ask questions. The time I was talking about when I was running from the police with your colleague, we didn't like attend the demonstration, but observe it, and it was in the city center, this Bristol Patriots gathering, people with Union Jacks around their shoulders, and like maybe 20, 30 people or so, some of them looking like really trained, muscle, neo-Nazi kind of guys, others just a bit lost, maybe drinking a cider or so. And you told me you think it's somehow like strategically or politically also can be important to talk to some of them. And you did already several times. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can tell us more about that.
Yeah, I would be really interested. Obviously, I'm very impressed by the anti-fascist scene in Germany. And I think I want to talk to you guys also of like what strategies you use, because I think there feels something a bit not working about the way we're doing it at the moment. I mean, it's great for us. It's great for the Antifa, because we're here in huge numbers and it shows that we're doing really well. And, I'm always like, it's a fantastic opportunity to see all your friends and, you know, people you haven't met in a while. And it was like your social calendar could be protests in Bristol. And that's great. But how it ends up is that here are all the anti-fascists, police line, fascists, and the anti-fascists are often saying like, "Nazi scum off our streets," or like, you know, these kind of things.
British slogans, so
yeah.
<The best. laughs>
and then the other side have some weird slogans as well. And then there was a very weird moment one time where both sides were saying Keir Starmer is a wanker. I was like, something we can all agree on. Great, the great unifier. But I think that I don't know. I think sometimes feeling oppressed is a great, or persecuted is a something that can make you double down more. And what I fear is with the far right, because the way that they are being kind of humiliated, and I understand it. The point is to make them feel like it's not fun to do this, and you know, I understand it as a strategy. I just wish we talk to each other a little bit more, and not in a kind of like let's all hold hands and be friends kind of way, but I think sometimes there is useful dialogue to be had, because I do think it's not like a particularly organized, often these people's ideology in Bristol, I'm talking about specifically, is very confused. They're not, I mean, I think people say, like a lot of people like are fashionably started doing Nazi salutes now. This guy who I confronted at this protest who was saying, I'm a neo-Nazi, and I was like, can you tell me which bits of the ideology interest you? And like, have absolutely nothing to say. So I think sometimes it's not a very coherent ideology. It's not particularly smart. It's also not very active. And I think for all these reasons, what I often see is the character of these protesters are like slightly confused people whose anger has been misdirected. And I think where that is the case, there is an opportunity for dialogue, even if it's just to understand. Yeah, I just think you have a better chance of being able to get through to someone, or, you know, where I think something like ostracizing people and vilifying people, it also can feel a bit classist, and I don't like that either. So often people think I'm really crazy, and then I also think that that's the crazy thing as well, because my friends will be like, don't go over there, it's dangerous. And then I was talking to the fascists, and they were like, you know, your lot carry little knives around to stab us. And I was like, wow, do we? Like, I had no idea. But, you know, and that's very interesting of like how each side is characterizing the other, and where there's fear, there is always hatred and division and whatever. But, you know, if I'm just like, please tell me about your views. I also think the NHS is shit. I also think that the bus services are bad. I'm just wondering why you don't blame the government instead of migrants. And that's a useful conversation, and a conversation that I have often spent time at these protests having. And the fact that all of these people always start with, listen, I'm not racist, yeah? But, and then they go on to talk about it, and then I'm like, this is also fascinating that you don't think you're racist, you know? So let's talk about that as well. I think I just wish there was more of a space for dialogue. I think we could do something. Yeah, I think it's a good strategy.
Thank you so much. And yeah, if you want to hear more, I really recommend you listening to the podcast, People Just Do Something. And we have some time left for questions. So if you have any questions for Priyanka about the Bristol Cable or any of their investigations, feel free.
Thank you for the talk. It was really interesting. I'm going to limit myself to one question. You talked about being targeted by the far right. I wonder what your thoughts are on slap suits, and maybe you got some idea or some tactics that you're using to avoid them or protect yourself from them?
It's a good question, but currently no particular plan on the slap suits aspect of it. I mean, we're such a tiny team. It's happened before where, I mean, we rely on, like, we have some pro bono legal advice or... and then we do have to hire a very expensive lawyer, which always just feels so painful when it's an hour for like a proof of an article or whatever. It hasn't happened to us yet in the UK. I know colleagues in Italy where it happens fairly regularly. But no, it's actually not something that we have thought about too much. And maybe we should, so thank you.
Yes, thanks a lot for the inspiring example. I was wondering, like, your members, are they like mostly part of the left scene in Bristol, or do you also manage to reach the people who are angry and like probably swing from left to right, or are maybe more leaning to the right but like not totally in this ideology yet?
I think sometimes it can be a bit difficult to assess the demographic of our readers, because we give out like 20,000 copies in the city for free, and we make sure to put them in areas which are not just like lefty hotspots, but just any kind of an area. In terms of our membership, I would say it is either left liberals, for sure, are overrepresented, but I think there are some, I wouldn't say right wing, no, probably not right wing, but I think there are some kind of centrists or like old school. Well, there's actually quite a lot of older people who read the Cable, because I think they just like appreciate the fact that we're doing good journalism and it's a paper and there's a crossword in the back. And yeah, but no, actually, I don't think they're becoming members, but I think we need to do more outreach to get them to become members, I think. Yeah. Thanks.
What is your perspective on a future accessibility of your medium, especially in times where digitalization is corrupting information? And yeah, are you planning on maybe even granting it in an analog way?
Analog meaning?
Maybe you already have. Is it in paper form as well?
Yes,
it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we are in paper 4 times a year, and then online for the rest of the time. And we've just started doing a podcast. And for sure, we want to move more into digital. Like, we want to do some more multimedia, different formats. I think just to have a breadth of formats, you have the best chance of reaching a wider audience. And I think for accessibility in particular, that's really important. I don't feel particularly threatened by, like, all journalism conferences can talk about at the moment is the rise of AI. And I don't feel particularly threatened by it, because AI cannot do the kind of reporting that we do. And I actually think by doing the kind of reporting we do, we have future-proofed ourselves in a way, because I think people will look to things which must have been written by a person. You know, I think the people will value more real, trusted information, and we will always be able to provide that. So I don't feel threatened by that.
Hello. Thank you very much for the interesting talk. Do you have some allies in Bristol or across the UK? In France, there is recently an initiative that has been started across 8 different independent media. And you can, for $25 in a month, have a subscription to all of them at once. Is it something you could think of?
That's a great idea, actually. We have networks, for sure. I think the Public Interest News Foundation is probably the strongest, that brings together all the independent local media. There are various networks, but nothing so coordinated. But I am also working on a bit of a secret plan to start developing the cable model in other newsrooms. It's something we're working on at the moment. We're still a little bit in the ideation phase, but I think that's the next step for us at the cable, is to, because our mission has always been bigger than local journalism. It is to try and change the media landscape. And so I think something like that will be exactly what we will try to replicate, of a kind of confederation of cooperatives or something like that, local media co-ops. But yeah, thanks for the example. That's really interesting.
Just a quick question. You talked about talking to people with a different kind of worldview, to put it nice. What point do you retreat from the conversation to protect yourself from it?
I think there's something about getting into the mindset of a journalist where you can take a lot more than if you were just a regular protester, if you know what I mean. You separate yourself a little bit from the interaction and you go into a mode of being curious and understanding, and, you know, to just hold yourself back a little bit. I think the worst thing I've ever experienced was that, a week after the Colston statue got pulled down in Bristol in 2020, the statue of a slave trader, you know, this was a huge moment of celebration for us, you know, very victorious. Then the following weekend, what people don't know is that then there was an All Lives Matter protest, and it caught everybody completely off guard, and there wasn't a very strong counter demonstration. A lot of, like, local biker gangs had turned up. Someone had come with an entire van full of Stella. I don't know if there's some kind of deal with Stella in the far right, but, like, Stella Artois, but they're always, like, equipped with that at these protests. And I think it got pretty hairy quite quickly, and all the other journalists left, and I decided to stay. And then I was kettled in with them. And then I thought, okay, shit. And I think then people were telling me to go back where I came from. They kept calling me a Marxist snowflake cunt, one of them called me. I was like, creative. And yeah, And I think then people were trying to snatch the phone out of my hands. I saw them pour beer on a photographer to ruin her camera. Like, that was like a bit more violent. And I think they were acting like that because they weren't being watched. Like, there was no counter protest, so they felt clearly very emboldened. What's the point where I think? I don't know. I haven't reached it yet personally, but I think it's a. I think it takes enacting this journalistic detachment thing, where you can just kind of hear it and then put it away. But when it happened to my colleague, that was harder. You know, then I was furious. Then I did lose a bit of my journalist. I was like yelling at him by the end. Like, so sometimes, yeah, it's not always possible to lose your cool, but I think I'm far more likely to get angry or on behalf of someone else than if it's just me.
Thank you so much for sharing your experience. I think, or I guess that your target audience is like a much more mature audience. So I was meaning to say, or to ask, how are your strategies into reaching out to a younger generation, which we also know that right-wing media are very smart in creating trends towards the youth. So I would like to hear more about that.
Yes. I think that we do have quite a broad spectrum of ages. It's definitely getting a bit younger now that since I took over as editor, I would say that I'm shifting the content a bit more radical. And that has got us newer audiences. But I think our strategy to try and engage younger audiences is to, like I said, do more kind of multimedia formats. Like a lot of young people is telling us that they prefer podcasts. They don't like reading. All the opposite. They say that they love print because they're so sick of social media they don't want to use it anymore. So we're hearing different things. We've now set up a more formal internship program with the university as well, and an investigation we're going to collaborate on is about student housing. And I think that's speaking to students about issues that are affecting them is one strategy. I do feel sorry for those two interns, though, because we're all like, so what did Gen Z do? Like, what do you like reading about? What do you think? And so they are having them in the office informing our strategy has been very interesting and unexpected. Like I say, like, I really didn't think they would say, oh, we love print. So they'd either, I'm hearing is that they would either listen to things, they're really into podcasts, or short videos, or the paper. But the website is the thing that they are saying they don't value as much, which is fascinating. But yeah.
I was wondering if you have any ideas of how to bring the media also to like the real local people living in villages or the suburbs. If you think about it, because at least in Germany, it's a big issue as well.
I have a take on that, I think.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because Radio Korax are doing this right now. They have a program called Platz der Republik, where they every other weekend are in a different small town or village in Sachsen-Anhalt. So you can find out everything about it by Googling Platz der Republik Radio Korax. And they, for example, they do a radio show on the marketplace and invite people, local, civil, parts of the civil society, and yeah, some activists, but also just normal people, invite people who just pass by to talk about Halberstadt, Zeitz. They're going to be, I think they're in Halberstadt this weekend, but I'm not completely sure. They're going to be in Zeitz in August. They will be in Löbejün next weekend, I think. So they're trying this, for example.
Yeah, I was just going to add that I know PIMF, this Public Interest News Foundation, they did this research, which we took to Parliament, about news deserts in the UK, like places where they're really, really underserved with local journalists. And I think one of the things that people can do is kind of organize across, like take an area and then have reporters in different areas and maybe find a way to collaborate or something like this. But yeah, it's a good question. And we are talking to people who are trying to set up news in those kind of areas, but I think it's a struggle. It's definitely a struggle.
Hi. Do you have any idea what the view around like other media, traditional media, and other journalists, like how are the cable viewed in terms of do like the traditional media think of you as like a radical left-wing media, or what's your feeling?
I actually think that we are taken quite seriously, and I think it's part of the reason why we don't go like in on left, we're left-wing, we're anti-fascist, that we don't go too far in on that branding, because at its core it's investigations in whatever form that's going to take, and like fascism is one kind of power, and you know, and I think maybe because of that, because of the fact that the messaging is more implicit and investigative, it's not so easy to like just for the right or the mainstream to write us off. And then I think because of a few very big investigations that the cable had done like early on, we're quite respected. Like one of the investigations was into a case of modern slavery, like in the very beginning, before my time. And the guy, the human trafficker, faced charges and, you know, liberated a lot of people who were living under these awful conditions and working for him. And I think because of those kind of things, we are actually well respected in the media, like for sure there's a lot of people who just thinks we're like loony lefties, or like a bit too worthy is something they say, which is a strange word of like, you know, you're too we're so principled or holier than thou. I think some people have said that about us, but I don't think it's true, or maybe like the Guardian regularly, well, the Guardian have on a few times cited us as a good example of journalism, independent journalism. The Bureau of Investigative Journalists recently praised our reporting on migration because of the framing around it. It was quite like novel to see a newspaper approaching that with a bit more empathy than the others. And also we've also taken part in quite a lot of government consultations. I recently was part of the roundtable looking at local media strategy. So I think somehow we've managed to be a voice in the room, even though we are obviously like a dissenting voice, but we're let in somehow, and I think it's because they can't deny our success. I think we're doing okay.
So if you want to support the cable, you can, or maybe we'll be around for a little time, you can talk to us later, because now we're running out of time. You can obviously become a member of the cable. Maybe you will be in Bristol for some time and read it. But I think, it's also interesting to read your investigations when you're not like have the local knowledge or not based in Bristol, because it's always like written for a broader audience or topics that take place in a lot of places, like, for example, the rise of a local far-right group and how they act. And also I want to say, if you want to support an independent local radio here, before the Landtagswahlen, the elections in September, you could become a member of the Radio Korax Freundeskreis and support it with a monthly payment, because what they really need now is money, and it's really existential important, because they have to pay rent and so on, and technique. And yeah, it's just a great place. You will find more information on the table there. You can also like sign up to become a member directly here before you go to Haupttresen or somewhere else. And thank you so much for listening. And thank you, Priyanka, for coming.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your work and for coming here and telling us about it.